This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Haitians in the United States protest a speech by the former U.S. ambassador, a key player in the rigging of Haitian elections. Brazil turns back the clock on its black and poor population, and a free school in Philadelphia celebrates 5 years of radical politics. But first, the United States bombed a Syrian airbase last week on the unproven allegation that the Syrian government was behind a chemical attack on civilians. Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly went on Sputnik Radio to talk about the consequences of the U.S. attack.
Well, I think the consequence will be to prolong the war, and I think that's the goal of U.S. foreign policy. The Trump administration said they had accepted that Assad would remain the president, and they no longer had a goal of regime change. But still, their goal was to partition Syria and to accomplish by other means what has been an American plan for many years, and that is to destroy secular governments in the Arab world. This chemical weapons attack, I don't believe that it was the Syrian government. It makes no sense that Assad would have had something of a victory and then would undermine it by carrying out this act. I think it's important for people to know that the so-called rebels, the jihadist groups, the Turkish-backed groups, the Saudi-backed groups have access to chemical weapons too. And it's interesting to me that these attacks always occur at some moment that is very opportune for them. And I think what happened with Trump is that it was an opportunity for Trump to increase his approval ratings. It's very sad, but it is true in the United States. Americans love a president who goes to war or who takes some military action somewhere. And some of Trump's critics have been praising him ever since these attacks were announced Thursday night. So politically, it made sense for him, which is a sad comment about this country.
Are you suggesting then that this was not about democracy or humanitarian intervention?
Oh, absolutely. Humanitarian interventions, the so-called right to protect, are always phony when carried out by the United States. The United States carries out very inhumane policies, supports very inhumane regimes around the world. And every time they claim that some military action is based on humanitarianism, we know that it's a lie. We know that we just look at Iraq, just look at Libya. Some leader is called a tyrant. We're told we have to save people from that tyrant and then respond by killing those same people. The United States is responsible for all of the suffering in Syria that's happened over the past 6 years. America's allies have carried out this brutality. The United States has backed jihadist groups, backed an al-Qaeda affiliate, al-Nusra Front, in this effort to carry out regime change and created awful suffering in Syria, thousands of deaths, the refugee crisis. All of this is at America's feet, and all because of a supposedly humanitarian decision.
You mentioned Iraq, you mentioned Libya, but why hasn't the U.S. pushed forward with an investigation into this alleged chemical attack? Why did they just launch a missile strike arguably within hours?
Well, it doesn't, investigating the attack would reveal probably that it was not the Syrian government. The goal is to keep practicing imperialism. So investigating the attack, finding out the truth, would undermine what is always the goal of U.S. foreign policy. And because Trump spoke about changing the relationship with Russia, because he's been accused of being under Putin's influence, carrying out an attack against a Russian ally gives him some protection from those charges. There have been hearings in Congress. There have been calls for him to be impeached, to be removed from office. And by taking this action, he protects himself politically.
What was their coverage over this supposed chemical weapons attack? Was that covered at all in media?
Well, it was covered, but it was completely biased. Right away, the New York Times and others said that Assad was to blame. It was all very flimsy evidence that the White Helmets told the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which I believe is one man in the UK, that this was evidence that these anti-Assad forces claimed that there was proof of Syrian involvement. This was all accepted at face value right away. And we were all told that Assad was to blame. There was no call for an investigation. There was no attention given to those who were critical, those who were skeptical. We were just told that Assad had done it, that people were dying. We saw pictures of suffering. And I don't mean to diminish the suffering, and I'm not saying it did not happen. But I am very, very skeptical. I find it highly unlikely that the Syrian government is the culprit. But we were told right away that this was an attack carried out by Assad, and that an attack on his government had to be carried out.
That was Margaret Kimberly of Black Agenda Report on Sputnik Radio. Haitian community activists held a demonstration outside Brooklyn College in New York recently to protest a speech by Kenneth Merton, the former U.S. ambassador to Haiti. Merton has been accused of being instrumental in rigging elections that put the U.S.-backed candidate, Michel Sweet Mickey Martelly, in the presidency in 2010. Daoud André was an organizer of the protest. We asked him why Haitian Americans would honor a man who committed crimes against their homeland.
Well, this is what we were there to denounce, especially the fact that it is a Haitian, quote-unquote Haitian entity, I have to say, because in the flyers we were giving out, we had Haitian Studies Institute, and to cite the language of the day, we say this is fake Haitian, fake studies, and a fake institute, because it is usually, Glenn, people who look like us that our enemies put in these positions so that they can do this dirty work on behalf of our enemies. So it was a very spirited protest. Like I said, we give out many hundreds of flyers to people going in. And we understand that throughout this event, Kenneth Merton was quite on the defensive, apologizing for this, apologizing for that, saying that, you know, he's not the one who did this, putting responsibility at other places where, of course, U.S. policy is responsible.
Well, of course, directly responsible was the Obama administration, but there's a new administration in town. Is their policy towards Haiti any better from what you can see of it?
Absolutely not. It's no better. As a matter of fact, some sectors in our community were pushing, demanding that Kenneth Merton be removed from dealing with Haiti policy at the State Department. But instead of removing him, the Trump administration seems as promoting Kenneth Merton. He has a more prominent position that puts him even deeper in charge of Haiti policy. And he was one of the three individuals at the State Department the Trump administration sent to Haiti to represent them at the inauguration of their new puppet in Haiti, Jovenel Moïse. We don't see any difference, Glenn. What we had said is that, you know, we were doing everything we had to do to ensure that the Clintons didn't get back in charge in Washington, because we know what they have done to Haiti, what they've done to black people over here and in the United States, non-whites around the world. So we said anything but Hillary Clinton, but it was with the clear understanding that were Donald Trump to have been the one in the Clinton's position, certainly he would not have given the gold mine contracts of Haiti to Hillary's brother, but he would have probably given them to his son-in-law.
So what we see in Haiti is a continuity of policy.
Continuity of Martelly. As a matter of fact, the new government that came in, the prime minister that Jovenel Moïse appointed, for him to get the votes, because certainly he did not qualify, he does not qualify for this position. He is a medical doctor, someone who was very close to the Americans in Haiti. He was the head of Rotary Club in Haiti. But he's someone, a medical doctor, who was doctor for so many prominent people in the country, charging exorbitant fees, but has not paid taxes to the Haitian government in the past 5 years, because you have to bring your tax papers to be qualified to get into this position. He didn't have any. The man never paid taxes. And for him to have gotten through, it was corruption, giving money, contracts, certain legislators, and the first time around, it seems that the money that he gave was not enough. And so the senators just did not show up to have a quorum. And in 2 days or so, they did the proper distribution, you know, separation of the cake that they usually do. That's what Laura Lamotte did under Martelly. This is how it happens. And the next time around, practically a unanimous vote. No one voted against him, although he does not qualify. And the policies that he is announcing, this is a continuation of the stealing of lands, of the agricultural lands for tourism, for factories, free trade zones, they call them, for going back into this mining, gold mining, that had been blocked in the last legislature. I have to tell you, that's beyond election of a fraudulent president. What they have right now, basically, is the entire parliament, like 90% the Martelly parliament that is there. So there is no opportunity to expect anything good to come out of this legislature or the executive that exists there in Haiti right now.
In terms of what we can expect further from the Trump administration regarding Haiti, folks should be reminded that the international arm of the Republican Party was very, very active in the overthrow of the Jean-Bertrand Aristide government in 2004.
Yes, you're speaking about the International Republican Institute. This is the body that all kinds of shenanigans to financing destabilization of democratic government. It's not just in Haiti that this happens. This happens all over the world. And as a matter of fact, this man who was in charge of the ERI in Haiti, he's been announced that he had a prominent role in the Martelly government, and again, he has a part in this new government. So we understand that it's U.S. policy, whether it's from Democratic side or from Republican side, that basically the policy that comes out of Washington with regard to not just Haiti, but especially Haiti, it has to do with pillage, it has to do with plunder, it has to do with domination, with the bending to the will that basically whatever resources exist in Haiti, the U.S. considers it like reserve for the United States, and basically for them to exploit it when they need it.
What do Haitians like yourself think when you hear American politicians, mostly Democrats this time around, complaining that the Russians supposedly have interfered inexcusably in U.S. electoral matters?
We laugh, you know, we laugh. We said that would be a good thing for them to get a taste of their own medicine. You know, it would have been nice if Vladimir Putin actually did something like this, because the United States needs to understand that just like them, all peoples should have the right to self-determination, to be able to live, to be able to make their decisions without undue influence, pressure, all kinds. I'll tell you something really funny. Like a couple of days ago, there was some OAS meeting in Washington, you know, of course, the OAS, Organization of American States. It's a sham organization, you know, that the U.S. has used for eons, you know, to dictate, you know, to impose their will on countries in Latin America. And they were having some meeting deciding whether they are going to condemn, to suspend Venezuela. You know, it's the continued persecution of the government of Venezuela. And prior to the vote happening, so you have this little clown, Marco Rubio, who makes some statement that, you know, little Marco, I have to say, quote Trump, you know, he is making some statement that Haiti better vote with the United States or else we're going to cut funding. So the United States needs to understand, like, when they speak about democracy, when they speak about, like, people making decisions for themselves, that it means something. But, of course, you know, on the other side, the reality is that this is all a sham. All of this Russia thing with regards to the elections, this is just the Democrats and some of these Republicans who are supporting Hillary Clinton, who still, you know, they can't get over the fact that this was just a stupid candidate for them to push. That Donald Trump, the clown Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton is the only person he could have beat in something like this. And they are still refusing to accept that she was just a bad candidate. She, in the right now, I see that they're trying to rehabilitate this individual. I don't know, maybe they're planning to not wait for the next election, where she might be too old by then, but to have a coup d'etat, take down Trump and put Hillary in the position. That would be so much fun for us to watch as Haitians, as people who have had governments in our country that were voted by the people get overturned, and have someone that we would have never voted for put in as the candidate. So we don't think there's anything serious in this Russia thing, and I think they know it. As a matter of fact, we agree with Donald Trump here. Why don't they investigate the actual links of the Clinton Foundation with Frank Giustra, who has the Clinton Foundation branch in Canada? And it's in his private plane that the Clintons, Bill Clinton in particular, traveled for so many years to Haiti and so many other parts of the world. And this is the man that is selling uranium to Russia, over the same Vladimir Putin. And I think any real investigation will probably show that whatever real contacts that Donald Trump and his people would have with Russia, the Clintons have even more. But, of course, you know, they will not investigate something like this.
The U.S.-backed forces in Haiti seem to have gotten down to a science the ability to limit the vote to about 20%, about one-fifth of the people. Doesn't that tend to make elections less than useful?
You know, the thing is, for many years now in Haiti, what the people realize is that they vote the candidate they want, the project that they want, and they don't get it. And the last election that you had where people came out massively to vote, well, not even massively, but in a greater percentage, was with René Préval's election in 2006, you know? And in this election, what people realized is that even when they voted Préval, those things they voted Préval to get, Préval couldn't deliver, you know? And so people don't see, in many ways, elections in Haiti. I don't know for about other places as well, and I'm picking the amount of our people who went out to vote Barack Obama and look at what they got, you know. But people realize that this is not what's going to get us anywhere. And so I think that what people are doing is investing in other means to get what they need. And besides that, the process itself, there's no way to trust the results of these elections. I'll tell you, we have this recording, and as a matter of fact, it's the last editorial that Jean Dominique, the famous journalist, did in he was killed the first week of April, April 3rd, 2000. And in his last editorial, before he was assassinated, it was an editorial denouncing this man, who, Leopold Bélanger, who was placed in charge of this last election that happened. And in 2000, Jean-Dominique was denouncing him for electoral fraud, that this man was manipulating results in an election that was happening in 2000. In the election, he had reports of him having tried to manipulate legislative votes in the 1990 election of Aristide. So now imagine that someone with such a record would be placed in charge of elections. So the results that these people give you, you have no reason to believe that they are good results. For example, in this last election, if you can imagine it, they had results that showed that Famille Lavalas, which is Jean-Bertrand Aristide's party, Marie's Narcisse, the candidate, had lost Cité Soleil to Martelly's party. This is like the most ridiculous thing you can say. This is like the bastion of Lavalas, the poorest neighborhoods in Port-au-Prince. This is the kind of place where the ghettos, you know, where this is a place that on any day Aristide would win like 90% of elections there.
So this was the equivalent of Donald Trump winning Harlem or Bed-Stuy.
Yeah, something like that. This is without Hillary Clinton as the candidate against him, because of course if it was Hillary Clinton, we would tell our people in Harlem to vote Donald Trump. But the thing is, it's like you have a serious candidate, let's say Glenn Ford, across from Donald Trump, and then Donald Trump wins Bed-Stuy. So this is laughable. So what we say is that there is no reason to believe the results of these elections that happen in countries like Haiti, and the results are manufactured at the U.S. Embassy. And as a matter of fact, after Martelly's election in 2010, you have an email like this from Hillary Clinton to her people at the embassy telling them, I love the way you do elections, that they had succeeded in imposing Martelly as the president of Haiti. So this is the reality of the elections in our country. There's another issue. There is this atmosphere here in the United States of panic within immigrant communities. And in our community, the Haitian community, it's no different, that the ICE, Homeland Security, has created this fear, at any moment, anyone without the proper documentation, and even people with permanent resident card, what's called the green card, can be subject to arrest, deportation at any time walking the streets. And this is not just in the Haitian community, in many Latin American communities, non-white immigrant communities. You have this reality where people are scared to go to work, people are scared to go to church, people are just afraid and moving, not staying in one place at a time. And what our organization, Komokoda, is pushing, we are telling our community, other communities, that definitely we understand that this is well-founded fear, not just from what's coming down from Washington, from Donald Trump and the other racist xenophobes like him, but you also have local law enforcement that is using this as an opportunity to prey upon the immigrant communities, like non-white communities in the, all over the United States. But we are calling on the African-Americans, progressive whites, like people of conscience in this country, to join forces with immigrant communities to fight in a very serious way to go on the offensive, basically. And despite this present moment of fear, to fight for general amnesty for all the undocumented who are here in this country right now. And we remind folks that the last time that there was a general amnesty in this country where people without documentation were able to have a permanent resident card, this was under Ronald Reagan. And the fact is, what history has shown is that the Democrats, they really don't have the courage. It's like they always pretend like it's the Republicans that are not allowing them to do this. But just like the Republicans, and even more than the Republicans, they are pandering. What they always offer is palliatives, you know, like sugar pills, instead of dealing with the real issue and give something that makes sense.
That was Daoud Andre speaking from Brooklyn, New York. The United States welcomed the impeachment proceedings that deposed the left-wing Workers' Party from the presidency of Brazil last year. In Washington, we spoke with Alexander Main of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He says the right-wing government that threw out the Workers' Party has the approval of less than 10% of the public, but has cut Brazilian social programs to the bone, as if it has a mandate from the people.
Well, absolutely. I think actually more than that, there's a sense from the big banks in Brazil, from the national and multinational corporations that are invested in Brazil, that this is an opportunity of a lifetime. So they need to push through all of their agenda while they have this golden opportunity.
So they're going for broke even if it breaks the country.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. And the further they go, the more it delegitimizes an already very illegitimate government. And just to remind your listeners, government came into place through what I think most people observing the situation would call a coup, a sort of a soft coup, where they used the mechanism of impeachment in the Brazilian constitution to remove the elected president Dilma Rousseff from power. She's from the left-leaning Workers' Party, even though she'd gone in something of a rightward direction, certainly on economic policy. But they used this impeachment when it is, in fact, designed to remove presidents who have been involved in criminal activity, who have done illegal things, and there was never ever any evidence that she did anything illegal. And so the whole process was illegitimate from the beginning. And yeah, the great irony is that this process was initiated by Eduardo Cunha, who now finds himself in jail over corruption. He basically represents a whole sort of political mafia that's in place that had it in for the elected president Dilma Rousseff, essentially because, one, she had allowed corruption investigations to move forward under her watch, even though many politicians from her own party were involved in that, and two, because they were adamant about pushing through this neoliberal agenda that's in place now. They have reformed the Constitution to allow them to put very, very strict spending caps on social spending in the country for the next 20 years, basically putting the country in a straitjacket under this constitutional amendment.
That really sounds like something new in the annals of law. Certainly the right wing in this country might hold up a budget, but a 20-year freeze?
Yeah, no, this goes far beyond. You know, we see similar things in Europe these days. Under the European Union now and their Pact for Growth and Stability, you have fiscal criteria that really reduces the budgetary power of individual states within that community. But this goes significantly further by essentially putting into place a freeze. Spending in key areas like education and health cannot increase, and in fact will decrease over time because it cannot increase in terms of just the absolute numbers, whereas, of course, the absolute number of Brazilians will increase. It's a country that has been rapidly growing in population, and so we'll have a shrinking budget in these key areas that were, frankly, very underfunded to begin with.
That sounds unsustainable. What has been the reaction of the folks who are going to be hit hardest by those freezes?
Well, I mean, there have been huge protests, and it's not just over these freezes. It's also over major pension reform, and those were the latest series of big protests that you saw throughout the country, where basically they're forcing people to work 35 years or more in order to be able to get any sort of public pension. And you've also had many public sector workers, including teachers in the state of Rio de Janeiro, for instance, that have not gotten their salaries or have only gotten partial salaries for the last few months because the state claims that they can't pay for these salaries, even though we do see them obviously making big tax cuts for corporations and very focused on making Brazil what they consider to be investor-friendly. So it's definitely leading to a lot of turmoil, and I'm reminded, you know, more and more of kind of the outcome on the ground in society in Honduras after the coup there way back in June of 2009, where you really saw not just a lot of people's uprising right and left throughout the country, but also a real breakdown of rule of law. And this is going to happen when you have authorities that people haven't elected, that people don't feel represent them. Authority becomes meaningless, and we're dealing with rising levels of crime in the country. And, of course, this is also very much linked to the economic situation, which is growing worse and worse. And, of course, with these sort of austerity measures of cutting back public spending rather than trying to stimulate the economy, the situation is getting worse. The country's been in recession for years now.
And what kind of shape is the Workers' Party in now? That's the party under which the poor and working classes made great strides in the 21st century.
Right, in the last decade or so, since the election of Lula da Silva, you know, way back in late 2002. And he was in power, of course, from 2003 to 2010. And then you had Dilma Rousseff, who was in power also from the Workers' Party. Again, her mandate was abruptly curtailed by this impeachment that was carried out last summer. And, well, the Workers' Party is in a state of crisis. They always had a sort of a tenuous hold on power to begin with because they were never able to get a congressional majority. And there are reasons for that. Brazil is sort of structurally, its politics makes it very, very hard for one party to have a real majority in the Congress, which means that the Workers' Party had to rely on alliances with right-wing parties. So a very tenuous situation the whole time, really. And that's why they succeeded in this impeachment against Dilma Rousseff. And now that they've gotten Dilma Rousseff out of the way, they're going after Lula very clearly. And they've been doing this for a while because Lula, he, of course, was a steel worker. He's someone that certainly the poor of Brazil very much relate to, and he relates to them. He has a real worker's background, and he's someone who's never forgotten that and certainly identifies with his class. And he was always resented by the upper middle classes in Brazil. The media was always vicious, but it's kind of gone to a new level now, where he is being constantly slandered and criminalized in the press. And you have right-wing judges that are playing along with this. And I'll just give one example, for instance. He was briefly arrested, and there was no reason for this arrest. It was basically to serve a subpoena. He was asked to testify in a corruption case, which there was no evidence of his involvement in it. But the judge decided that he could make Lula look like a criminal if he basically served an arrest warrant against him to force him to come and testify, when, in fact, Lula had never been reluctant to testify. So it was all a big staged incident, which was very much used by the Brazilian media. You know, they had him in handcuffs, accompanied by police, even though there were no criminal charges against him. He was still hauled away and became a huge media spectacle. And this is something that just has gone on and on consistently and has intensified recently, especially as Lula today is really the most popular politician in Brazil, despite all of these attacks. He's someone who lower-income Brazilians really relate to and believe in because, as you were saying, great strides were made during the Lula years, during certainly a part of the Dilma years, and they are seeing everything going in reverse. So they're just wanting to vote in accordance with their interests. Therefore, there's a major campaign against him. They want to take him out. If they don't manage to jail him, they want to just slander him so badly that he becomes completely politically toxic. Will they succeed? I don't know. But there is a powerful media machine out there that's out to get him.
Brazil has a well-established, mature, and broad-based left. The left isn't limited, certainly, to the Workers' Party. What are the general outlines of a plan of resistance?
Well, there are broad coalitions in place that are organizing protests fairly regularly. Of course, there is, at some point, protest fatigue. There were enormous protests right after Dilma Rousseff was ejected from power through the impeachment, and there was enormous repression in response to that, very violent repression, which I think made a lot of people more reluctant to protest. And so you haven't seen kind of the same numbers since then, but you see frequent protests. And really, that's all they have at this point. There aren't elections until 2018, so all they can do is rely on street action, getting people out in mass. There have been big strikes. But again, we're in a situation where you have really the economic powers in Brazil, particularly I would say the financial sector, feel that this is the time to move or never. The government that's in place, I think in their mind, is disposable. And it is hugely unpopular. And I think it is going to be the end of the current president's career, Michel Temer. I don't think he can ever hope to have an elected office again after this. But it doesn't matter to them. I mean, the advantage of having a government like this one is that there's nothing to lose. They might as well do everything they want now. And, you know, you still have the security apparatus from the Brazilian dictatorship that's still in place, which is the military police. The National Police of Brazil is militarized and is under the authority of the military. And, of course, the military still has a lot of very right-wing elements within it. So you have an apparatus in place that's kind of well-designed to deal with the current situation, and I think will continue to do so. But I think you can expect more and more instability as a result.
Well, that is a great question. Brazil, like almost every place else in Latin America, was under U.S.-backed military dictatorship not that long ago. Are folks afraid of a return?
A lot of people are afraid of a return, especially as, you know, you're seeing kind of counter-protests of the right, where you have people from the upper classes take to the street with huge signs basically welcoming the return of a military dictatorship. So that is a popular sentiment, a growing popular sentiment among the upper classes in Brazil, this idea that if we have a military dictatorship again, we can kind of restore order and, of course, marginalize these more rebellious elements within the population that want to see some social progress, a little bit of social justice for the country. So I think, you know, they're very much counting on that. And there is that possibility. But I would say, in a sense, Brazil is under a dictatorship at the moment because you have a government that is absolutely illegitimate in place, that wasn't elected, and of course is following an agenda that was never voted on by the people of Brazil and is quite contrary to the will of the majority of the people of Brazil.
Brazil is the blackest place outside of Africa. How was that population faring and reacting to this new situation?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, this is a little-known fact, but Brazil actually has the most descendants of Africa of any country in the world, even Africa, bigger than Nigeria, for instance. So they have been, and of course, Brazil was the last country, I think, in the world to abolish slavery. They waited until the 1880s, and much of Brazil had and still has structural racism, particularly in the north of Brazil, where you have more the blacker population. That is the real core of the base today for the Workers' Party. It comes from the north of Brazil, from the blacker parts of Brazil. And there's a reason for that. It's because the Workers' Party did a lot to really help a lot of Afro-descendant communities emerge, basically become more full citizens by providing them, a lot of them for the first time, access to higher education. There were massive scholarship programs. They had basically affirmative action programs in place as well. And of course, the anti-poverty programs under the Workers' Party benefited those communities in particular as well. And these higher income Brazilians, very white higher income Brazilians, were very resentful of that and felt that suddenly black Brazilians who had, quote-unquote, known their place for such a long time were suddenly feeling empowered and becoming a competing element within society in that they were gaining access to education, therefore to higher skilled jobs, so competing with the entitled white people of Brazil. So certainly things have been backtracking since then. These affirmative action programs are being done with. There was a ministry, sort of Afro-descendant issues, which has been done away with. And symbolically, I think what's significant is that you have a government that's entirely white in a country that self-identifies in its majority as non-white. The entire government is white and male, so not at all representative, and certainly pushing to dismantle some of this progress. And there was still a lot of progress that needed to be made, that still needs to be made. The overwhelming majority of the poor in Brazil are Afro-descendants. And there was a ray of hope under the Workers' Party governments, and now things have clearly gone in reverse.
You recently wrote an article calling on the U.S. Congress to pay more attention to Brazil, but some folks might say that the U.S. has paid plenty of attention to Brazil, and that's why we have the situation that we're discussing right now.
That's a very fair point. And essentially what that article was about was Congress taking on the U.S. administration for supporting this soft coup against Dilma Rousseff last summer. So you had some members of Congress, the more progressive members, a lot of members of the Black Caucus, that basically told the administration, you can't do this. You're supporting a completely anti-democratic development. But of course, you know, you're right. This is what the U.S. does. Whenever you have a progressive movement that takes power, and particularly in the U.S.'s proverbial backyard, the U.S. government gets busy trying to undermine it any way possible. So really, the Obama administration's position, in which it supported the coup that had occurred in Brazil, was really quite natural in keeping with the long track record of the U.S. in the region. And essentially what I was saying was that those members of Congress that have been critical of U.S. foreign policy in other parts of the world should focus more on the damage that the U.S. is doing in Brazil, as well as other parts of Latin America.
That was Alexander Main of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. In Philadelphia, the Saturday Free School will celebrate its 5th anniversary on April 15th at its home in the historic Church of the Advocate. The Free School began operations at Temple University, but soon found out that elite educational institutions were part of the problem, not the solution. Nandita Chaturvedi is a student, a teacher, and an organizer at the Saturday Free School.
The word free means both that it is free, as in you don't have to pay anything to be a part of the collective, and also the fact that we are committed to the truth, and so we believe in free thought. And this does not mean that we think that we don't need to have discipline. We are not anarchists, but we do believe that we have to have critical reasoning and thought to understand the world. And this is why we also base our method and theory in the works of Du Bois and James Baldwin, because we believe that they engage in the search for truth by explicitly rejecting academia and this idea of objectivity, and they put their perspective in the lives of poor and working people.
Now, I know, of course, you do study for the sake of study, but also with organizing as a central part of what your work is.
Yes, we think of ourselves as an organization of organizers, but also a school for organizers. And this is sort of an intellectual community where we come and we talk about theory so that it can help us guide our practice. And we have organizers that work in very different communities. We have people from the South Asian community that work in the South Asian communities in Upper Darby. We have East Asians. We have young black people. We have students from temples that do student organizing. And the question of practice to us is very important, because we also believe that you cannot have true knowledge unless it comes with struggle and practice, and that theories that can change the world come from working with the people.
In its 5 years in existence, what kind of impact do you think you can point to for the Free School? What has happened in Philadelphia because the Free School was there that might not have happened had there been no Free School?
The way we have been reaching out to people is organizing these conferences where we talk about ideas and center the battle of ideologies. And I think right now is when this is very important. And this is true because we're at a time when the left is in some sort of decay, because they see themselves aligning with the Democratic Party and the war machine. And I think the Free School puts out a very strong ideological stance consistently. And as people see that there is an alternative way to do politics that speaks to people and that comes from people and that engages in practice, people are drawn to it. And we've grown larger and larger in the last few months, and all of our people have become contributors to the process of knowledge production that we engage in. So I think that is the most important way we're contributing, right?
Not long ago, Philadelphia was the site of a very large conference on the Black radical tradition, and folks who were involved in the Free School had a lot to do with that.
The Black Radical Tradition Conference was organized by a group called the Black Radical Organizing Collective, and I think the organization itself has become a part of the Free School, and it operates as a part of the Free School. And so all the conferences we've organized after the Black Radical Tradition have sort of been in that spirit and building on the discussions that happen in that conference.
Even though you're headquartered now, or you hold classes now at the church, it does cost something to maintain this Free School. How does the school pay for itself?
Well, it costs something in the sense that every Free School, we pass around an envelope and everybody can contribute what they want to the church. But apart from that, when we have these conferences, the Church of the Advocate has been very generous to us. It has been a home to us in its truest sense, in that it has given us space and resources to organize these conferences.
You're having a conference on the 15th to mark the occasion. What's the theme and what do you hope to accomplish at the conference?
Different questions that the Free School has been engaging with over the past year, and we hope to have a constructive discussion about things such as the importance of political education in building a revolutionary front, the ideas of internationalism, and what does it mean to be internationalist in this moment in time? In particular, what is the importance of building an anti-war movement?
Political education is at the heart of what the Free School does. What strikes you about the level of existing political awareness among the young people and the not-so-young people that come to the Free School?
Well, there is definitely a difference in the way we engage with the world. If you look at people who have been part of political movements in the 70s and the 60s, I think their consciousness is much more developed as compared to the young people that come to the Free School. And I think this is part of what is very special about the Free School, is that both generations are in dialogue. And I think the younger people have a lot to learn, but also a lot to say. So we're always engaging in this dialogue. And I do think part of the reason why the youth today is at a level of consciousness that is low compared to the 70s is the fact that the universities have dominated what is considered to be radical thought. And so you see this in how prevalent identity politics is among the young people who are looking for a way to understand the world and their position in the world.
You sound like you're saying that the universities are part of the problem, not the solution.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is one of the main things we want to stress on consistently in all our events, is that we reject the university as a source of knowledge and we reject the university as a source of radical thought because of systemic reasons. We're not making a moral stance. We're not making a moral judgment on the people involved in universities. We are simply saying that the university acts as the ideological wing of the state, and that the radical ideology that they claim speaks for the people has nothing to do with the people. It comes directly from a co-optation of radical thought and gives the impression that we're working for change while we're just supporting the system as it is.
What's the next step for the Free School?
In June, we're trying to have a conference on the works of James Baldwin, which I think will be very important in defining the next steps for the future. I would say that is the next thing we're building towards, and we hope to have people from all over Philadelphia and all over the country.
Yeah, do you think every city can sustain a free school like Philadelphia has?
Well, every city that has working people can definitely sustain a free school. I think it needs commitment from people who want to change the world, and it needs a concept of history in the sense that we need people who have lived through and made history. But I do believe it's possible in every city.
Nandita Chaturvedi of the Saturday Free School in Philadelphia. The nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, finally forced prison officials in Pennsylvania to treat his life-threatening hepatitis C infection. He produced this commentary for Prison Radio, titled The Illusion of Correctional Medicine.
In the netherworld of American prisons, one must jettison any medical assumptions one brings in from the so-called free world. We've been conditioned to see nurses as sweet sources of solace and doctors as people dedicated to healing the sick and easing our pain. In prison, new roles govern medicine and care. Here, money is master. The ill are all but ignored. This may seem harsh, but I must assure you, reality is even harsher. Recently, I wrote of jailhouse lawyer Dennis Solo McKeithen and his battle to get examined and treated for the painful nerve disorder known as shingles. As I read this trial transcript, I found the remarkable comments and questions by the judge instructive. He asked essentially if the company hired by the DOC to provide health care had a conflict because, as a private company, its interests were to make money by refusing to provide medications needed by prisoners. The witness denied his suggestion, but the judge had hit a nerve. From 2015 to today, my lawyers and I have been demanding real treatment for my hepatitis C infection. The DOC initially filed a false affidavit which justified a U.S. magistrate's dismissal of my own suit. The DOC argued that my hepatitis was fine, that it could go years without treatment. A federal judge disagreed and held a hearing which showed the affidavit was false, and months later declared the DOC its so-called protocol was unconstitutional. The DOC fought back, arguing that my hep C was at a low level. The judge again disagreed, declared the protocol unconstitutional a second time, and ordered me treated. The DOC essentially ignored the court order for close to 2 months, and earlier this week subjected me to more testing. Well, the results just came back. Not only do I have advanced hepatitis C, I have cirrhosis of the liver called F4 because the DOC didn't want to spend the money to treat my infection. The DOC said it would cost them $600 million. It may only cost me my life.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.